Now that fall is here, many species will begin migrating to warmer climates for the winter. Monarch butterflies will head all the way to Mexico. On today's edition of Please Explain, we're looking at why so many creatures make these long journeys and how they know when and where to go. And we will find out how climate change is affecting animal migration. Joining me are Leanne Kreitzman, science writer and co-author with Russell Foster of Seasons of Life and Rhythms of Life, both published by Yale University Press, and Dr. David Wilkov, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, also director of the program Environmental Studies, as well as the author of No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations, which is published by Island Press. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, David, is there one single definition of migration?
There really isn't. Most people, though, think of migration as the animal that moves seasonally from one place to another, hangs around there for some period of time, and then returns. Kind of a round-trip journey. But there are other variants of that. So sometimes the species engage in more of a nomadic wandering. Other times that round-trip journey may actually take several generations to complete. It just depends on the animal we're talking about.
So I would assume some, simply because the species, and I'm afraid to just say animal because it also involves insects, are going to warmer climates. In other cases, isn't there a thing called loop migration where species migrate back to the place that they were born?
Oh, yes. In many cases, that's so, or at least close to the place that they were born. But, for example, sometime tonight, a black pole warbler is going to land in Central Park. It's going to spend tomorrow morning foraging, and maybe tomorrow night, after it's dark, it's going to continue on its journey. Now, that bird was born somewhere in Alaska. It weighs just a few ounces, and it's headed for the Amazon. And if all goes well, if it survives, sometime in about May, it's going to appear again in this neck of the woods, and it's ultimately going to head back to some area around where it was born. Probably not the precise place. Well, on the other hand, go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to say, on the other hand, there are other species that really do go back to the very spot they were born. A good example is sea turtles. So the sea turtles hatch from their nests in the beach. When they are just a few minutes, a few hours old, they scramble down to the ocean, and they head out to sea. The male sea turtles will never come back to that beach, but the females will wander the ocean for maybe 15 to 20 years, and when they are ready to breed, when they've reached maturity, which takes them that long, they will somehow manage to get back to the very beach where they were born, a place they last saw for just a few minutes 20-some years ago. It's a remarkable journey.
We're talking about migration on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Leon, do we know how they do that? And how important to this whole thing is the circadian clock?
Well, what David was beginning to describe to you was the dynamism that's involved in migration. It's very much a sort of very flexible activity, and there's a spectrum of behaviors. As he was saying, some go to place A and come back to place B, some don't. It varies from species to species. But when we're talking about the annual migration, the sort of seasonal shift of a population from one place to another, leaving probably an unfavorable environment at the time, moving to a more favorable environment, probably to breed, and then returning, then essentially those species, and birds are probably a prime example, in a sense have to plan their year. They have to have a way of knowing when to leave where they are. They arrive at where they're going. They then have to breed, they then have to raise the young, they then probably molt, and then they have to have a date when they say, hey, better get ready to start going back. So they need a calendar, and if you like, the same sort of schedule that you have on your fridge. And the way they do this it varies to an extent from migrant type to migrant type and species to species to a bit. But they do one of two things, or both combined, or even a third one to throw in just another sophistication. They can measure the day length. They know how long the day is, in a manner of speaking. And if you know how long the day is, you know roughly where you are in the year. So you know the date. They also know the time of day because they've got a circadian clock. And in the 1930s, a German scientist called Edwin Bunning sort of came up with the idea that from this circadian rhythm, which is a 24-hour rhythm, and it's difficult to visualize this, but in your head, it's really a description of a state. But think of a sine wave, a nice, smooth wave. And that's a daily occurrence. And at various times of the year, certain points on that curve will be exposed to light or will not be exposed to light. It depends on how long the day is or, conversely, how short the night is and the other way around. And it was that sort of concurrence that provides a means for determining a behavior which is done, if you like, calendrically at different times of the year. No magic in it, no counting. It's a way of doing it.
But
if you're a bird in, say, Central Africa, there's not much of a change in that day length. It's roughly 12 hours every single day of the year. And they also have another timer, which is called a circannual timer, which sort of strikes twice, once going and once to tell them to come back. And this occurs in birds. It also happens in hibernating ground squirrels. If you keep them in constant conditions, they'll still go through a hibernatory behavior once a year, even though they don't actually know the day of the year or the calendar. So they've got a very sophisticated mechanism. Plants can also do this, and they use light not just to see things, but as a source of information.
So whatever the reason for the migration or the change, the hibernation, we're talking about hardwired behaviors?
Sorry, I didn't catch that last couple of words.
Whether these are all hardwired into our genetic codes.
David will probably tell you more about that, but there's a genetic programming that sort of sends them off. But the behavior that they then follow depends on whether they're novice birds or whether they're experienced birds. And as I said, there's a lot of a huge spectrum of behavior in terms of the actual migration. But to a large extent, there is a genetic determination, but not entirely.
David, you wanted to add to that.
What Leon said is exactly correct. There is a genetic template there, but experience makes a difference. And we know, for example, that the older birds tend to be more successful in terms of the routes they take. And we also know that in some species, the hardwiring plays a bigger role than in others. So that little warbler I described, it's pretty much on its own as it heads out from Alaska trying to get to the Amazon. On the other hand, if you take a bird like the whooping crane, the youngsters fly with the parents. So they are learning, even on their first journey, some of the information that their parents have gathered about good places to rest, places to avoid, dangers, that sort of thing. It varies from species to species.
Well, even smaller than those warblers, and I wonder how the warblers get all the strength to cross large bodies of water, but I guess that's part of their makeup. Monarch butterflies are really small, and they're now making their way from the northern United States to Mexico.
I think that's the most mysterious of all of the animal migrations I've looked at, because what happens is the monarchs that are heading south now, the ones that you can see in this area, are all moving, the ones in the eastern half of the continent, are all moving to a small area in western Mexico, in Michoacán, where they will spend the winter in some of the high-altitude forests. In the spring, the survivors are going to head north, And they're going to make it about as far as the Gulf states, Louisiana, Georgia, places like that. They're going to lay their eggs and they're going to die. Those eggs become caterpillars, which become butterflies, and their children continue the northern journey, and they too lay eggs and die. And then the grandchildren continue north. And it takes about three or four generations to repopulate, to get the butterflies back, say, to New York or Massachusetts. And it's only that last generation, the great-great-grandchildren of the original butterflies, that instead of continuing north in August or September, which would be a very foolish thing to do, they will turn around and they will head south and they will somehow get back to that tiny area of Mexico that was last seen by their great-great-grandparents. It's a remarkable migration.
Do other insects do this sort of thing?
Not much in the way of, there are some locusts that do an annual migration, but it's not huge, if you like, in the insect world. But I mean, the monarch butterfly, you're quite right to highlight it, because it is beautiful. It's not just beautiful in terms of being an animal, but that sequence that was just described has a certain awe about it.
And we'd much prefer to have a monarch butterfly come our way than a locust.
I would accept that.
Now, do they...
Leonard, I do have to add, though, that the monarchs are in a great deal of trouble because of the destruction of the forests where they winter. So yeah. It is a phenomenon that we cannot be confident will still be with us.
So what would happen?
30 years.
What happens when the place they normally migrate to is destroyed? Do they find other places to go to? I don't mean the butterflies in particular, but any migrating species.
It depends. In some cases, they can move around, but in other cases, their requirements are quite specific. Their habitat requirements are specific, and they really find themselves homeless for a portion of the year.
Well, I'm wondering what's happening with climate change, because I'm assuming that if things get warmer sooner, then they're responding to those signals, and then they're going to go to a place that has been changed an awful lot since their species first started migrating to it.
Yep. There's a classic study in the forests around Arnhem in Holland where there are oak trees, and these oak trees, the leaves, are eaten by the caterpillar of the winter moth. But there's a very narrow time window because the young leaves start to produce tannin, which makes them indigestible to the caterpillars. So the caterpillars eat the leaves, and the caterpillars in turn are eaten by birds. And one long-distance migrant is the pied flycatcher, which comes from West Africa. Now, the problem is that the caterpillars and the oak leaves respond, in a sense, to temperature cues. So the oak leaves are coming out a bit earlier in the year. The caterpillars are coming out a bit earlier in the year. But the pied flycatcher in West Africa is still leaving in terms of this circannual clock that I mentioned. So when it arrives, and caterpillars are wonderful food for young pied flycatcher chicks, the peak of the caterpillar population has already passed. And in about the last 20 years, they've found that the pied flycatcher population in that part of the world has declined by something like 80%. And this mismatch in timing is a big problem for animals which are using different timing cues. And that's one of the big problems of climate change, apart from the actual physical change in the vegetation, what have you, that they'll be trying to eat.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite listener calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Leon Kreitzman, who is co-author with Russell Foster of Seasons of Life and Rhythms of Life, both published by Yale University Press, and also Dr. David Wilkov, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. He is the author of No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. It is published by Island Press. Again, the number 212-433-9692. talking about migration on today's Please Explain with Dr. David Wilkov, Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, author of No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations, and we'll get into that decline later. Also, Leanne Kreitzman, who has written with Russell Foster Seasons of Life and also Rhythms of Life, both of them published by Yale University Press. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, what about human migration? Hasn't migration been something humans have been doing since our beginnings, but are doing less today?
There's been nomadic humans. In other words, they followed their animals around, and that's been going on for quite some time. But migrations of humans tended to be one way, as I said, apart from these nomadic humans. What is interesting is the effect on humans of seasonality. For many years, particularly in agricultural countries, there would be a peak in births around about the spring equinox, sort of late March. This, of course, has been ameliorated because we're industrialized and we don't live in a natural environment anymore. We live indoors, we live without much in the way of natural light. So our inherent timing mechanisms have been affected. But it's a very interesting point as to what extent humans have ever been photoperiodic in the way we described earlier for birds and other animals. But we do have seasonal effects. We all know about seasonal affective disorder, which will affect, I don't know, probably about 5% of your adult listeners. We also have fluctuations, predictable cycles in our immune systems. And there are other sort of seasonal-based events that affect human physiology and human biology. For example, there are the suicide rate in the Northern Hemisphere peaks around about late May.
Now, I was wondering about ducks. I've always thought that ducks migrated, but I've noticed a lot of ducks remaining in New York City's parks over the winter. If you go to Prospect Park or Central Park, you see them swimming in the pond even on the coldest days. Have they changed the migratory patterns? Is it because they can find food to eat even in the coldest days that they don't want to bother migrating?
Yeah. Well, we have seen a number of bird species that used to leave this area regularly in the winter, linger longer, or even overwinter. And my suspicion is that they're responding to the fact that the climate is getting warmer. The winters are, on the whole, getting milder. Mm-hmm. Another example that I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with is the Canada goose. When I was a kid, the Canada goose really was a bird that you enjoyed watching in the spring and fall as they migrated between their breeding grounds in the Arctic and their wintering grounds in the Carolinas. And we didn't have them all over the place all the time. But a few things happened. We created all of these office parks with lawns and ponds. And wildlife managers who were actually concerned about the Canada goose a few decades ago started introducing them to areas where they had not previously been in the summers. And we now have a resident population of Canada goose that's probably bigger than the migratory population. Many of these animals can be quite responsive to changes in their environment. The migration may be to some degree hardwired, but it's something that can, for some species, be turned on or off depending on the environment.
Let's take some calls. Chet from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I've got two quick questions. One, I'm pretty sure that maybe half a century ago, that multi-generational monarch migration was unknown. So I'm wondering, how long ago was that discovered? And two, what do the Mexicans, they must see this enormous incoming swarm of monarchs, and did they know what was going on? They probably didn't, but I'll hang up and listen to your answer, okay?
Do we have any sense of pre-Columbian reaction to monarchs showing up every winter?
there really are no accounts of that.
I can't help you on monarchs, but it was only around about 1800 that it was generally accepted that birds migrated. They thought that before then there was quite a large school of thought that they actually hibernated. Some of them even thought that they sank to the bottom of ponds and spent the winter there. It's very difficult to get into the minds of people back in those times.
David, you wanted to add something?
In the case of the monarchs, there was really no evidence that people knew about the wintering grounds, although one has to imagine that the people living in the immediate area must have been aware. But it was a scientist in Canada who was determined to discover the wintering grounds of the monarch, and he pioneered putting little tags on their wings and then having volunteers all over eastern North America watch for them. And he gradually got enough data that he could figure out that they were heading towards Mexico. And he went to Mexico, and he couldn't find them. It's just too big a country. So he began a real publicity campaign through the Mexican media. And finally, in the late 1970s, someone alerted him to the presence of the monarchs in this small area of Michoacán.
That recently, wow.
Yes, it was remarkable.
Janet from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to add that the monarchs hang out in trees, and that the trees turn to this orange flaming tree instead. But my question is, I have heard that hummingbirds go on the backs of other birds and to get to their migration point. And I'm wondering if that's true and if any other species, maybe even the monarchs, do that.
This is David Wilcove. That is one of the most widespread beliefs among people who are interested in birds. But in fact, there is no what we would call scientifically confirmed case of hummingbirds riding on the backs of geese, although you will certainly find people who claim one way or the other to have witnessed it or to have evidence that it occurs. But it has never been demonstrated.
Stephen from Bayside, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, looking at the incredible complexity of this hardwired behavior and the multi-generations, which is virtually impossible to give a real mutational explanation. Do any of our scientists ever puzzle whether this, in fact, it has a dissonance with their evolutionary presuppositions?
Either of you want to tackle that?
Sorry, could you tell me the last four or five words?
Whether this has a dissonance, a difficult complexity for the evolutionary presuppositions that declare that this must have all happened through, say, random mutation in essence. Do you ever look at this and wonder whether that's actually a sufficient explanation?
Because we often use the evolutionary explanation to explain all sorts of behaviors.
Yeah, well, you've got the evolutionist sitting next to you, so I think I'll hand that over to him.
David?
No, I've never questioned that. I believe that the incredible migratory tools that so many animals have are indeed a product of evolution, in part because I'm constantly amazed at the number of remarkable traits and abilities that evolution has crafted, and it often just takes us a long time before we really understand the mechanisms.
But your
and
book,
when we do...
Go ahead.
Yes, go ahead, Len.
No, I was just going to ask you that your book is about the decline of the world's great animal migrations, and I was wondering about why there is a decline. What happens? Is it all because of humans? Are we playing a major role in the whole evolutionary process?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Migratory animals need room to roam. They need not only a breeding habitat and a wintering habitat, but they need places to rest and refuel along the way. And regardless of the type of animal you're talking about, the way in which we as people have used the land, the air, the water has created all sorts of barriers and obstacles and difficulties for these species.
Well, if a dam is built and fish can no longer get to their spawning grounds, do they find alternative places to spawn?
They do not. That's why the salmon population in the Columbia River, which was one of the greatest runs of salmon in the world, is now perhaps somewhere 95% reduced in numbers because of the dams that have made so much of that river inaccessible to them. If we're talking about mammals like antelope or bison, simple things like the construction of fences and more complex things like the building of communities and towns can really destroy key wintering areas, block migratory routes. Sometimes the animals are able to adjust, but often they can't. And when they can't, that usually leads to big declines. And we're seeing that. We're seeing significant declines in migratory songbirds, in some of the great mammal migrations, among fish. It's happening across the board.
Yes.
Go on, Leon.
Yes, I was going to say that at the worst case, we may well lose getting on for 50% of all species. The problem is severalfold. There are physical barriers that weren't there before. A road, for example, or a railway track and aspects like that. But also the timing element, the one that I tried to talk about with these pied flycatchers, is disrupting these very intricate ecological webs. It's not just an individual species, but a whole community that goes down. And one of the great dangers, well, it's a great danger as far as I'm concerned, because I actually like to think that there are wild animals and wild plants there, and they're surviving and even thriving. But we are killing them off quite quickly. And the fear is that, you know, my grandchildren won't see many of the animals and plants that I was lucky enough to see. And I think that's a shame.
Well, I'm going to sneak one more call in here in connection to this. Sean from Bradley Beach, can you make it quick?
Yeah, sure. I think that a lot of the questions I had asked or were going to ask have been answered. I think some of these ideas about, like, putting wildflowers on the sides of the roads are all just feel-good ideas for humans to avoid the fact that, you know, the only thing that's a disruption to all migration in the world is the human species, and there's really not much we can do about it unless we wholesale change the way we live. And your guests have basically said that throughout their entire show.
Well, so let's sum up with as a form of summation, talk about whether any of this can be reversed, or are we just too far gone?
I don't think much of it's too far gone. We're still growing the world's human population is still growing. We're still using up resources. We're restricting the wildlife population. David can tell you much more about that in terms of the technicalities. But it's very, very difficult. You can conserve, and, you know, people are doing terrific work and doing wonders. But quite frankly, I think we're on something of an inexorable trend. And I think that future generations are going to be diminished by the fact that we allowed this to happen.
30 seconds, David.
Well, Leon may well be right, but I hope there's a way to protect migratory species and other species. If you look at it now, there's still a tremendous diversity of migratory animals out there. And I think with the right commitment to conservation across borders, we may well be able to save at least some of them for future generations.
Dr. David Wilkove is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. His book, No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations, published by Island Press. Leon Kreitzman, he is co-author with Russell Foster of Seasons of Life and Rhythms of Life, both of them published by Yale University Press. Thank you both so much for being with us on today's Please Explain.
It's a pleasure.
On Monday's show, we'll come to you live from WNYC's Green Space. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band stops by to perform songs from the new album, and then comic actor David Alan Greer. Also, Coleman Domingo on his new play, A Boy and His Soul. Plus, the former editor of the Oxford English Dictionary and an etymology expert, answer your language questions. If you'd like to be a part of our live studio audience, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen, Stephanie Bernhard, Ida Sadakiani, and Miranda Schaefer. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Monday at the Green Space.